Hope everybody is doing their best right now as we're going through this crazy time in our world. I'm Tony Bruschi, host of Real Ghost Stories Online. I wanted to invite you and let you know about our other brand new podcast that we just launched, Help Kill the Time for You. It's called The Dark Side of Wikipedia. It's about true crime and dark history. We dive into some of the strangest, most disturbed minds and experiences from our history and examine their story, their Wikipedia entry, and then discuss the cases, the individuals, and the psychology of the events as we go through each and every story. Some of our first episodes include Ed Gein, the BTK killer, the New London school explosion, Amityville murders, Richard Speck, Amelia Dyer, the General Slocum disaster, Jeffrey Dahmer, and more. New episodes every single week. Check out Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search it. Subscribe wherever you download podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and more. It's available now with new episodes every single week. Dark Side of Wikipedia. Search and subscribe today and stay safe out there. Today on Real Ghost Stories Online, after going to bed one night, a woman is awoken to find her brother wandering around her house in the dark. Only problem is, her brother is dead.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802 or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You are about to enter the world of the unknown and quite possibly the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
That it is. 855-853-4802 is our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online to share your real ghost story with us. You can write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. If you really want to support the show and get a whole bunch of extra ghost stories to binge away on, our archive of more than 300 EPP bonus episodes, extra podcast person is what that stands for, you can get them at ghostpodcast.com or go to patreon.com/realghoststories. $5 a month gets you access to all of the bonus content. You get brand new bonus content every week, advanced content before it's released to the public, commercial free, our ebook, our audiobook, so many extras there. And that's what helps keeps us on the air. So we greatly appreciate that support. Check it out. Like I said, ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/realghoststories. Tony and Jenny Bruschi joining you once again.
Hi.
Hi, and how are you?
Fine.
I'm finding some more information out about...
the zombie mink?
Not zombie mink, but the ability for some creatures to actually... zombietize themselves.
What?
Or something does that to them. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a real thing.
Great.
I'm reading Scientific American.
Okay.
Which has been a magazine that's been around for...
Scientific journal that's been around...
175 years.
Yeah, it's a respected publication. It's not just like joesideas.com.
Which has been the main place most people have gotten news in 2020.
Yeah.
Joe's Facebook page said it was real. Okay. Thank you. So anyway, this is interesting. Zombie ants.
Well, that's ants. I mean, those little ants, fuckers are hard to kill anyway.
But just the concept and the fact that this thing can exist is kind of scary. I'm going to read some of it here. In the Brazilian jungle, at the height of just about 10 inches off the ground, carpenter ants can be found with their jaws permanently locked on a leaf, frozen in a never-ending dance as an alien stalk grows through their head. These ants are the victims of, I'm not going to be able to enunciate it, Ossifiitis urolithialis or something. I don't know.
Some sort of disease.
Also known as the zombie ant fungus. The fungus first enters the ant's bloodstream
as single cells, but those cells soon begin copying themselves and importantly building connections so those individual cells can share nutrients. These connections set on the fungus and it sets it apart from other fungi that simply kill off their hosts and eventually form networks that wrap around the ant's muscles. As the fungal network grows, the ant's body succumbs to the fungus's control. So it like takes over. It like hacks the system of the ants and does what it wants, not what the ant wants anymore.
So it makes these ants like the kid on Troll 2.
What happened with the kid on Troll 2?
He like turned into a plant.
Well, kind of, but he doesn't like turn into a plant. The ants don't turn into plants. This fungus is in their body and it's, so I guess kind of. Interestingly, the network doesn't appear to reach the ant's brain. Entomologists are not sure whether the fungus releases chemicals that affect the ant's brain from afar, effectively killing it as far as the ant is concerned, or if it takes a more sinister approach by leaving the ant's brain alone to witness and remember the takeover, but cutting off any muscle control and thus the brain's ability to stop it. Either way, the ant is compelled to leave its colony, climb up a nearby plant to the precise height above the jungle floor where the humidity and temperature are optimal for the fungus to thrive. The ant is enforced to bite into a leaf to maintain its position, never to move again. But the fungus isn't done yet. With its host in perfect position, the fungal passenger forms a stalk that breaks through the ant's head. Okay, so it does kind of get troll-like. And produces spores that then rain down on the other ants below, grabbing more victims. Jesus, this is weird and scary. The zombie ant fungus isn't alone in having the power to manipulate its host to serve its own interest. For example, in an attempt to gain entry into host birds, a type of flatworm first invades the brains of California killfish, causing them to exhibit conspicuous swimming behaviors that make them more vulnerable to attacks by those birds. But it does so... But it does show a so far uniquely known ability to adapt over different climates. As mentioned, the Brazilian flavor of fungus directs its host ants to hover around 25 centimeters off the jungle floor by biting into a leaf. The whole stalk and spore creation process that spreads the fungus to other ants takes 1 to 2 months. However, in cooler climates like in Japan and Southern Carolina or South Carolina, the ants are found instead clinging to twigs and trees several feet off the ground. In these climates, the spreading of spores takes over a year, so the zombified ants must survive a winter season during which the leaf might fall to the ground, but a twig will endure. The scientists leading the study, including David Hughes and Raquel of Penn State, had a lot of help from citizen scientist Kim Fleming, who carefully documented the infestation of zombified ants that call her South Carolina property home. In a very unique claim to fame, the strain of fungus infecting her ants is now known as, again, something I can't pronounce. The changing climate that inspired this particular adaption is expected to have happened in the distant past. But what does this mean for the rapidly changing climate we live in today? If the fungus is clever enough to alter its plants to accommodate the seasons, what adaptations will it see next?
See, this sounds more like possession than zombie.
It kind of does. But the fact that this thing can take over the brain, what is scary to me about that is like, oh, well, science isn't showing that it even hits the brain. So the ant can be fully conscious of it doing things that it can't control.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, it's Jesus. If it can happen in that species, I mean, you start thinking about things that would cross over or someone would, you know, try to manipulate as a weapon of some sort.
Don't give people ideas.
I got the idea listening to the Ghost Show and how to weaponize zombie ants.
Yeah.
That'd be an interesting headline. Be like, no shit.
Zombie ants, murder hornets, whatever.
It's all coming to you in 2021. 855-853-4802 is our phone number here at Real Ghost Stories Online to share your real ghost stories with us. We'd love to hear them. First story, it says, hello, Brewski family. I hope today finds you well. My name is Allison, and I've been listening for a few months now, mostly at work. I cannot explain it, but there is something extremely soothing in hearing spooky stories and knowing that I am not alone in my beliefs and experiences. I recently became an EPP, and I'm really looking forward to all the extra content. I feel like you've created a little community here among your listeners, and I really think it's lovely. Anyway, I have at least a dozen or so stories I could tell about my family's brushes with the other side, but today I wanted to tell you a story on behalf of my mom. Most everyone in my immediate family, mom, dad, sister, me, and now my kids, are sensitive to the paranormal in one way or another. However, none of us quite as sensitive as my mom. Seemed like there were always little things happening around her, like spotting our dog in the yard, although he had passed the year before. There were multiple mornings when she did not feel quite right because she'd experienced sleep paralysis the night before. One morning, she swore one of us girls had shown a flashlight in her eyes in the middle of the night, only to wake to have no one there. The call came later that morning that a relative had passed right around the time she was awoken by the light. When I look back on it now, it's almost comical how casual she had always been about these kinds of things. It was just second nature. One of the best stories she always told was of the time she was visited by her favorite uncle, Joey. My parents were married in 1977 and lived in North Jersey until the day they moved down the shore shortly after my birth in 1979. My sister would be born in 1981. Anyway, Uncle Joey died in 1978 and thus never had a chance to meet us or visit the new house. But one night he finally did. My mother says she woke in the middle of the night to find him in the house, just kind of looking around. He was wearing the suit he had been buried in with one of his trademark fedoras. My mom was so happy to see him, but clearly confused, she asked, "Uncle Joey, what are you doing here?" He said, "I never got a chance to see your new house." She says she then followed him around as he went from room to room, just kind of peeking in and checking everything out. Neither of them spoke for the rest of the visit. She says it lasted maybe 15 minutes. This is a part that always seems to baffle my mom every time she tells the story. When it was time to go, Uncle Joey went to the front door. When he went out, Mom says that he joined countless other spirits that were just floating down the street to, quote, "and then he just went out the door. And there were all these other people just floating down the River Park, the street where we grew up on, just floating. He joined them and just went down the street." The next thing Mom knew, she woke up in the morning. It was so real and she was so affected by the experience that she was afraid she'd get out of bed and find a fedora on the kitchen table. Mom always laughs at the last part, but possibly finding the fedora on the table. I'm sure it would have scared her at the time, but to have that proof of the visit would have been incredible. Anyway, that's one of my family stories. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm sure I'll be writing it again soon. Thank you for all that you do. Keep up the good work. You are not just providing entertainment, but a gathering place. Take care, guys. P.S. I need to know, did Harper ever get to try that Star Crunch? I'm dying to hear what she thinks. Aha. Uh-huh.
Did she?
She has tried the Star Crunch.
And
her reviews are mixed, depending on the day.
Okay.
Some days she's like, "Yeah, it was really good." And some days she's like, "It's an okay cookie."
Has she tried a Nutty Bar yet?
Yeah, she likes the Nutty Bars.
Those are my favorite.
Those are delicious.
That's why we don't keep them in the house.
Yeah, no, but she, I think there's still a Star Crunch or two in there. So it hasn't been like, "Oh, I must eat these." Her thing this earlier this year was honey buns.
Yeah, like she couldn't get enough honey buns.
I think I have honey buns like in our storage of food. We should probably check the date on those and have her enjoy some honey buns again. Yeah. But yeah, the Star Crunch. You know, I think they're good. I think they're smaller than they used to be.
Okay.
I had like, these are like half the size from what I, but I think that's all. I don't know if
your
I'm smaller.
Your hand is twice as big than it was when you were a kid.
Yeah. I said the same thing to my Uncle Jeff the other day when he was giving us some heirloom family furniture. And I said, I remember these being bigger. But again, I was half the size.
Yeah.
The last time I really remember, you know, like playing around some of these things. So I suppose the same could be said of a Star Crunch. But I...
It's just a weird thing to say.
It is. But I'll tell you this much. Halloween candy has shrunk in size. That's not all in my head.
That is fucking bullshit with that whole thing. Fun size was just fine. And then they took it and they made it half. And so you get this tiny little square of Snickers or whatever. And I hope the candy companies are listening because it is bullshit. It's like you need to go back to the size that it was when we were kids because that was a decent amount. That was like a third of a candy bar. That was good. This is like just a bite. This is like what Karen moms give to their kids. And it's like, no, this is not going to work. This is not Halloween.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to that rant?
No, I've had a bad day, so I'm going to rant about Halloween candy.
It is bullshit.
It is.
It was. I always thought it was ironic when they call it fun size.
It's not fun. It's like fun is when you get full size.
No, fun is king size.
Yeah.
Fun is king size. Satisfied is regular size.
And I'll be quiet and shut up and be a good kid is fun size.
Yeah. And now the shit they have going out there is like
a joke.
It's fuck the world shit. That's how you get children to turn. And that's how you get kids going crazy.
They need to rise up and boycott the little tiny candy bar bites.
Yeah. I think some protesting is in line. We have a helicopter.
I could say some stuff that would be very bad. But
helicopters on the street. It appears in downtown Manhattan, people are rioting over fun size Snickers.
And then they still call it fun size. It's not. It's half the size.
I don't know what they would call it now, though. I mean, they kind of fucked it.
Like, joke size.
Yeah. Your fucked size.
Cheap ass motherfucker size. That's what it is.
It is. It is disappointing. The pain is real. 855-853-4802 is our phone number at Real Ghost Stories Online to share your real ghost stories with us. Let's go to our next story. It says, I work in a haunted medical building. I'd rather remain anonymous for several reasons. My husband retired from the USAF in 2014 and is currently employed by the unique aerospace company that makes private jets. He works at their headquarters and could be easily identified. I work in a unique subspecialty of medicine and have an uncommon name that would also make me easily identifiable. I'm extremely cautious about telling my story because even my own husband did not genuinely believe me until I brought home proof. It started in 2014 after we moved across the country, and I started working in an old medical building that is not too far from a still active teaching hospital dating back to the early 1900s. The teaching hospital I'm referencing has pioneered many modern-day medical treatments. I also believe they had an insane asylum, but you will not find that history listed on their modern-day website. They have big ties to what we would call old money, for lack of a better term. My first experience included hearing people talking, tapping noises, lights turning off and on by themselves, and crashing noises. I've experienced these things separately as well as all occurring on the same day. On many different occasions, sometimes I would hear what I would feel to be a group of people talking just outside the range of being able to clearly understand what they're saying. Instinctively, I know it sounds like 3 to 4 people or more conversing with very dated music in the background. Amen to the old CB radios. You know it is a male. You know it's an English language, but you just cannot make out what is being said. Kind of like white noise. It almost feels like there's a small party or get-together taking place. I'm sure there was a rational explanation behind what I was experiencing, and I would get up and look around the office just to make sure that I was there alone. I was sure it was nothing paranormal. After all, I work in medicine, which is a science-based field. What I found out later was shocking, to say the least. It was not until I had to go in late at night to see an emergency patient that I'd find out more. Coincidentally, I connected with the night janitor just recently. He made me question the thought that everything could be explained by science. When the janitor proceeded to tell me what a former doctor had done in that very space I worked in, my jaw dropped, and I had a pit in my stomach as I had never felt in my life. What kind of doctor claims a schizophrenic's body from a teaching hospital and keeps their brain on his desk? Apparently a neurologist. A doctor claimed the body of a man who was severely mentally ill that passed away, who had no known relatives to contact for burial. This was done during a period where this would have been acceptable and would not have been considered unethical to keep human remains, especially for a neurologist. I soon accepted the unusual happenings in my office were not scientific, but I wasn't about to say a word to anyone other than my husband or the janitor for fear that people would think I was the crazy person. The only reason I felt comfortable talking to the janitor is that unknowingly he seemed to be having the same experience as myself. In casual conversation, I laughingly mentioned that the building was a little creepy at night when he said, "You have no idea, this place is haunted as hell." Of course, it opened the door for questions. He seemed to have no issue telling me about some of his nightly experiences. I'm sure I had the deer in the headlights look trying to keep myself together when he mentioned everything I had experienced and worse. The building is currently under renovation, and the activity has picked up. I recently read this can make these kind of things worse. I've begun to notice an uptick in the frequency of experiences and can no longer question if what I'm experiencing is paranormal. And without any doubt, this is something otherworldly. My most recent experience has left me to wonder, is there more than one person or thing? What the hell is it? Is it possible this thing or things are malevolent? I audibly heard it 2 inches from my ear. It growled at me. I have full body chills just typing my story. I can still hear it. And this time, I caught it on a recording on my phone. My husband was speechless after listening. Please reach out to me if you want more information, or if you'd like to hear the recording that made my husband a believer. I only ask that my real name, city, and specific occupation remain anonymous. You can send that audio to Jenny at...
No,
don't do that. But if you want to send it to me, tony@realghoststoriesonline.com, go ahead.
So I would lay money there's more than one thing in a size facility like that, especially with the kinds of things that went on. I would just say it's not just one thing. And I bet you the night custodian would tell you as well that there's multiple things. And something that growls is not something to be messed with.
If it growls, it goes.
What?
It means you get rid of it.
Or you try.
You try to get rid of it. Yeah, growling entities are not usually of the favorable kind.
No.
So, but what do you think is going on here? Do you think it connects to the brain in the jar that was on the guy's desk for all those years and just... that soul, that individual that, you know, was just kind of looked at as a specimen more than a human being?
I think indirectly. I don't think it's necessarily the spirit of the person whose brain was in a jar on a desk as an ornament. I think it was more so, it's more representative of how people with issues and, you know, mental illness were treated back in those days as more than they were treated subhuman.
Sure.
And so I think that it goes back to that. They were not given, you know, the care that you would expect in this day and age, obviously. I mean, back at the turn of the century, not this one, but the last one in the early 1900s, people would go and tour asylums instead of zoos because that was more fun and that was an allowed thing.
Yeah. It was like socially acceptable, which is,
yeah,
we look at that today and go, they did what?
So a family on a weekend could spend their day, oh, we're going to go to the asylum and watch the crazy people there, their words, not mine.
Yeah.
And then we're going to go have a picnic in the cemetery. And that would be a very acceptable, socially normal weekend.
The good old days.
So I would think it has to go back to how these people were probably treated or maltreated. And I hate to think about the kinds of things they probably went through because they were treated like, you know, specimens, social experiments. And, you know, they didn't know so much about mental illness back then. So they were trying to figure things out. So what do? You do everything you think of to try and figure out what happens.
And the torture that those people ended up going through.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, what do you think we're going to look on? Obviously, we'll be dead. But what do you think grandkids will look back upon, or great grandkids, 100 years from now of this point in time and go, holy shit, they did that? Like how we would look at literally how, like, they would go to the mental institutions for entertainment.
Zoos,
period.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Just the holding of animals.
Yeah. I mean, because some are set up more humanely, habitat-wise, to where, you know, the animal obviously knows it's not in Africa, but they have gone to such a great length through donors and things like that, that they've set up habitats to where it's as realistic as you could make it.
Well, and some of the species have been saved only because of zoos.
Right, but then there are some where, in the last area that we lived in, it was very much like, small cages.
Yeah.
These animals are not happy. They're not, I mean, I won't say they're not taken care of, but they're not given the kind of habitat they need to thrive.
Yeah. Joe Exotic style.
Yeah.
Where it's like this, I get you like cats, but there's no human way possible to take care of these
And I started thinking this when circuses were basically, circuses ended.
For, circuses are done.
Yeah. I mean, there are a few independent circuses that go around, mm-hmm. but, you know, the big once a year Ringling Brothers circus that we would go to as kids mm-hmm. or I would go to as a kid, you know, that we thought nothing of, that's something that, you know, is gone. And I think, and you know, it may not be our grandkids' generation. It may be their kids' generation. But mm-hmm. I could see zoos being the same thing.
Yeah. I'm going to go out on a limb here because I just have to answer the question with something. But I could see this being something that changes. Nursing homes and facilities that are... I thought it was going to be impossible to say that this would happen. Because you're assuming you'd have people housed and have people caring for you, which that's not always the case. But I wonder if we're going to have less of the, okay, we're going to take grandma to the facility now. And if we're going to have more of an in-home care type thing going on, almost reverting to the past in many ways, people looking at the way that, and I'm not in any way saying all nursing homes are bad. There are some very well-maintained, well-taken-care-of nursing homes, but God knows there's a lot of bad ones too, where there's abuse and maltreatment and all that. But I'm wondering if that is going to shift in 100 years. And people be like, really? Like, we used to put people just like in these small little rooms, and then they'd watch Wheel of Fortune and just wait for them to die, essentially?
I mean, that shift is already happening.
It is happening. I'm just wondering if it's going to happen so much that there really is very little of that at all anymore. And all you're going to see that exists there are is literally would be folks that have no means or have no family that are there to help them or take care of them.
I think it's going to take a lot longer, though, for that to happen because we have so much of an aging population that's yeah. coming on the cusp of
sure.
needing full-time care.
That's where I'm thinking 100 years from now, they'll look back on that as like, oh my gosh, they used to do that with their old people. And it's kind of like an American thing.
Mm-hmm.
Other country, I mean, there are certainly nursing facilities in other countries, but I don't know who pioneered the idea, but there's a lot of cultures and a lot of countries where that is just you. There's no way in hell you would do that to your elders. Well, they're revered, they're respected, and you hold on to them even through their most trying times until they're dead.
I think it's a modernized holdover from the asylum era.
Yeah, it is. It's just it's modernized and it's more humane.
Yeah, and I'm not saying nursing homes are asylums, but I'm no. saying, you know, when they first decided, oh, here's what we're going to do with these elderly people who no longer can function at their full cognitive ability or their physical ability. We're mm-hmm. going to put them all in a facility.
Yeah.
That's what they've done for, you know, a couple hundred years with people, but they just don't call it, you know, asylum.
Yeah. The name changes.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to put down nursing facilities because no. they are definitely needed and they are definitely not all bad.
No. Go ahead.
I would say the vast majority, I mean, the way they're changing them now to have like little main streets and things mm-hmm. like that to make it, you know, more comfortable. It's not like the nursing homes where we used to go visit where there was like the nursing station and then four hallways yeah. that kind of spread out, you know. I mean, that's, and it was just, The only entertainment they had was to sit in the hallway and watch people walk by.
And the reason a lot of times people end up in a nursing care facility is because the spouse or the children or whoever is there cannot care for them in their home
yeah.
anymore. And here's where I think that will change, because I think technology is going to continue to advance so much that it will be doable at home. It'll make things much easier to maintain and manage that individual with, you know, what will replace the nurse that comes by every so often to check. You'll have technology that does this, that can check things, can check vitals, can tell, say they need this, they need that. And you'll have services that can come by and deliver certain things. But I think you're going to have it so made essentially convenienced that it becomes much more practical and probably affordable, because that's the other end of it, for that to be done in home versus in a facility. But I do think you're right. I think it'll be, we're not going to benefit from it, but I could see that at some point, that's the way it's going to shift dramatically.
I could see that being something that comes out of COVID, actually. Not so much, I'm not saying that we can replace nurses with robots by any means. Please do not take that as my meaning. But I'm seeing, you know, we're all seeing how just overrun these nurses are and how they're working, you know, months straight without a break. Same with the doctors. I mean, they need some sort of relief or something to help them to be able to do their job more effectively. So they aren't just, you know, they're not run so ragged with taking care of so many ill at the same time. So I almost wonder if we're going to see some sort of serendipitous inventions come out of COVID to help the nursing world. And I hope.
Yeah. I mean, what likely I think will end up happening here will be eventually COVID will calm down and things will get back on a normal path, but you're going to have so many people in the medical community just so burned out and like, I'm doing a new career now. I have to mentally and just no fault of their own. They gave their everything. But you're going to, excuse me, I think have shortages of that, of staff, of nurses and things of that nature. And I think technology will find ways of maybe filling in some of those gaps where it's like, there's these shortages here. Is there something we can do automation wise that can fill that gap? Will it ever, you know, be perfect? No, not at first. Sure. Will not. But I think in time you may find ways that may end up being more efficient and even be better for the patient. I mean, this is what happens in pandemics. This is what happens in crucial times of survival in human history. You essentially have innovation that would normally take 30, 40 years to take place, happens in the course of 1 to 2 years.
But more of like a task-oriented type of innovation, not at all.
Not everything.
Trying to replace nurses because you can't. I mean, but what do you do when the heroes burn out?
Yeah. And I think that's, you're going to be almost forced at some point to have to find some of this stuff. And as everything evolves and changes and people get into the field who weren't even part of it during this, it's going to be a new world with all that. And I think it'll definitely affect the nursing area. So that's our look into the future today.
And we'll see, you know, in 20 years, if there's any movement towards anything that we've said.
Yeah. It would be interesting to look back on that at some point and go, we were talking about that not that long ago. Although it seems to be half the stuff we predict, it's like within a couple of weeks, you're like, hey, here's the article about it. So, although Zombie Mink.
Didn't have that one on my shit board of bingo for 2020.
Make it shit, just S-H-I-T. I think you need one more to make the full diagonal though, don't
Exclamation point.
There you go. Exclamation point 32. Shit Mink. There you go.
We should make that and people print it off and we play along.
That would be fun.
We should do that for 2021.
Just random. When I was talking with Harper the other day about this on the air, and I said, it's almost like you just picked two random words and put them together for 2020. Zombie Mink. And voila. That's
it's
what
either
you got.
A band name or something that happened in 2020.
Exactly. Blind Melon. It's a 90s band. Yep. You know, all different things. A lot of 90s bands had names like that. Mm-hmm. Zombie Mink. Let's go see Zombie Mink at the Coliseum. That'll be a great show. I can't wait. I hope they do a good cover. All right. That's going to wrap up today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. If you like the show, help keep us on the air. Become an extra podcast person. EPP, as we call them. Sign up at ghostpodcast.com or patreon.com/Real Ghost Stories. We greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, for Jenny and all of us at Real Ghost Stories Online, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening.